Hey, shalom everyone. I'm Amir Tsarfati, live from Connect in Galilee, Israel. And today we have a super special anchor podcast for you. We have live from Berlin, Germany, Mansur Ashkar, who is actually a friend of the family and someone that my kids know pretty well and my wife's family know very well. But to my shame and guilt, this is the first time I get to meet with you. Shalom, Mansur. How are you, my friend?
Shalom, and thank you for inviting me here. I'm doing well, given the circumstances. And it's an honor finally to meet you. I always used to hear about you from your kids. They admire you whenever in the youth camps or summer camps. So, you know, when you see the children, you know who the parents are. So I'm very honored to meet you now.
Thank you. And again, okay, so we spilled the beans and everybody knows now that you know my kids from youth activity in the body of Christ here in Israel. You are indeed a believer, a local believer. Now you live in Germany, you're married, you have a son there, and you live in Germany. But obviously, you were born and raised in Israel, you served in the military in Israel, but you have a very special a background that most believers in Israel do not have. You are a son of the Druze community, which you will in a few minutes tell us a little bit more about, because everybody hears about the Druze in Syria and the Druze in Lebanon and the Druze in Israel, but very few people truly understand who the Druze really are. But you are of a Druze family. You came from a family that your father was an exceptional officer in the IDF. You were raised to love the country and be part of the security issues that are part of our lives here. You yourself served in a special unit in the IDF, and even the rest of your career, even as a civilian, was related somehow to security and securing people. I'm not going to say where exactly and what, but I will ask you to tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and how you came to faith in Yeshua as a Druze that lives here in Israel.
Wow, that's a good question. So just like you said, I'm a Druze, born and raised in Israel. My family is very Israeli, very Zionist, very patriotic. My grandfather was the highest ranking officer in the Druze community. He kind of opened the door for many other officers to come after him. He was the first non-Jew to light the Mesoah, the beacon that we do, you know, in Independence Day. He was the first non-Jewish person to do that. And he was awarded, you know, by the prime minister back then and the Ramatkal. He fought in the old Israeli wars. I myself went in his footsteps and also became an officer. I was in the special forces. You know, we're a family of warriors. Grow up in Israel, my grandfather fought in all of the Israeli wars. He named my mom Medina after the nation of Israel. Medina, that's the name of my mom. So you can understand that I grew up very connected to this land, very connected to its people. And that's part of the beauty of the Druze, which we will, you know, dive in about it. I served as an officer in a special unit mainly focused on saving hostages. It was a hostage rescue unit. There's only a few of them in Israel. And after a while, I decided to go and just travel the world and work around the world. And I end up working in different security jobs all around the globe. Regarding your questions, how did I come to faith? You know, there's a verse that says, seek and you shall find, you know, and I think I just really was seeking. I was truly seeking. And as a kid, even, I had the questions of who goes to heaven and what's the path to go there? Because I want to be close to God. And then I came and I said as a kid, okay, if you're born Muslim, they tell you Islam. If you're born Jewish, they tell you Judaism. If you're born Christian, they tell you Christianity. If you're born, you know, each religion kind of, you know, talk about itself. So I said, God, I honestly don't care which book you want me to read. I just want to find you. So I used to pray and I said, I will pray to you through everyone. I will pray through the faith of the Druze, the Christians, the Muslims, the Hindus, the Jews. It doesn't matter to me. I just don't want to be born in the wrong place. And because of that, miss that opportunity. And I became very curious about religions. But then when I first met, we call them Messianic families in Israel, I met a few families, and that's the first time that I felt that they walk the talk, that they're doing things genuinely, not just because it's a religion, but actually because it's a personal faith. When they choose not to lie, when they choose not to cheat the system, evade taxes, or just, day by day stuff, they're doing it because of some conviction that they had with their faith. And I came and said, that's the first time that I see a real good practice of religion that is not just very religious, but it's actually very personal. And it was just a normal evolution. Just started going through it until I realized that, this is the order of things, how things make sense. Judaism brought us the Torah. Yeshua brought us, the Brit Hadashah and the, salvation after that. Muhammad kind of flew out of the window, was not relevant anymore in that picture. And I just kind of realized that this is the path. And for me, that was for many years. I just started personally studying it and reading it and keeping it, to myself, obviously. Pretty much until I became an officer in the army, and that's when I had a conviction that I was not really practicing my faith. And then I remember I came and said, okay, but how can I practice my faith when my job is a very violent job? I'm an officer in the special forces. But then I realized, wait a second, what was really bothering me is how can I take Jesus to be my example in that? And a really cool story is I came and said, okay, Jesus didn't come with the image of a warrior fighter with a big sword. You have that aspect of him. But it was more about love and compassion and forgiveness. But then I said, you know what? Jesus did the most amazing leadership. I don't want to call it trick, but leadership act. He went and he washed the feet of his disciples. And that's when I said, as an officer, I'm going to be a servant to my soldiers. I'm going to go and I'm going to do the dishes when I need to do with them. I'm going to clean the bathroom with them. I'm going to go and I'm going to stand guarding with them when I can, because sometimes I can't. And through that, I'm going to be the best leader that I can for them. And that was inspired by actually taking the story of Jesus and bringing it into the life of a combat officer in the special forces. And I think that created such an amazing bond between me and my soldiers. So anyway, sorry, I went kind of sideways, but that's in a nutshell, how did I ended up leading the youth camps in Israel and taking Israeli kids up the desert and teaching them the Bible.
Yeah, exactly. And both my son Ariel and my daughter Mayan, they remember you very, very well. And also, I think you were at the age of the younger sisters of my wife, so they know you very well. I know that my father-in-law Hanan used to know you pretty well and often talked about you. And you grew up in a very I say a great example of coexistence when it comes to the place, the town where you lived. Where is it exactly in Israel? Obviously, all Druze live in northern Israel, but which part in northern Israel are you from?
So I hail from the mountain of Carmel, the Usfia village, so we're neighbors even on top of
Osfia.
everything. And also my mom's family came from the village of Megar,
Ah,
which is in the
yes.
close to Nazareth by the Sea of Galilee.
Correct.
So that's the two areas that I came from, which are very Druze village, but also they're mixed. They have Christians in them, they have Muslims in them. Nowadays, there's a lot of Jews living there because the real estate in Sfia is easier. So yeah, it's a very unique environment to grow as an Israeli, I feel. But then I moved to
Yeah,
Eilat when I was a young kid, and I moved to a Jewish city. And we were one of the first Druze families to actually leave, because the Druze is a very secretive and closed community. And back then, it was not common at all to leave the village and go live among secular city like Eilat with the Jews away from the community. So we were
and
one of the
Eilat is a
first
resort.
Druze.
This is a resort town by the Red Sea, so it's like the Vegas of Israel when it comes to what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. So Eilat is like that one for Israel.
Eilat started as kind of a reject city. People that didn't get along with authority or something, they just tell them go down to Eilat, stay there, and they invite all the hippies and beatniks, and they started kind of this Las Vegas of Israel. So yeah, we were very, very odd bird when we first reached Eilat, with the Druze flag, with my mom, with the futa, this head cover that she wears. People didn't know where did we come from and who are we in the beginning. It was very interesting.
Wow. So, and that caused you to even more be immersed with the Israeli vibe as well as the local believers, because there was the shelter in Eilat, I think, and some of the believers that live there and that everybody here in Israel know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Great. So, so now here you are, a Druze that came to faith in Yeshua. By the way, how did your parents accept that? How did your extended family look in?
Here's the thing about the Druze religion. It's actually, as secretive as it is and close, it's very accepting to other religions. So I kept it in secret. I was terrified to tell my parents, you know, that I'm having questions about faith and I want to learn about other religions and I want to learn about other ways and I want to learn about God, you know, myself. And then at the age of 21, when I decided to like really, okay, I'm going to go and I'm just going to reveal it to my family, my mom came and told me I knew it all along. And I was like, what? I'm telling you, I was like terrified. That was one of the most biggest burden stones that I had to lift from my shoulders. And I thought it's going to be a huge drama. And then she says, I knew it all along and I saw that it makes you happy and it makes you a better person. So I'm happy for you. My father just gave me a tefach on the shoulder and told me, good job. That's it.
And it's interesting because a lot of people, you just said the Druze is secretive and they're accepting and all of that. But many people don't even know who the Druze are. Where do they come from? Where do they exist here in this world? You know, I was a tour guide for many, many years in Israel. I used to travel and show, we used to travel all the way to the place of fire of Elijah, the Muhraka, and we would drive through Esfia and Dalyat El Carmel many times. And so that would be my chance to explain to people about the Druze people. I think it's the best thing is to hear it from a Druze. Tell us where this group of people come from. Where this faith and what is it all about?
All right. So theologically, the Druze see themselves as direct descendant from Jethro, the father-in-law of Moses, the father of Zipporah. And that's one of the reasons that they feel very connected, by the way, with Christianity and Judaism. Now, they see it as a secret religion that was kept to itself, and at different spikes through the history of mankind, they came out and revealed themselves to the world with a different, you know, purpose, you know, to do something, and then kind of went back to the backstage and just kept for themselves, practiced, you know, their own religion, and were, you know, working and living among, you know, other religions peacefully. In 1,000 years ago, that's when the theology of the religion is saying they came to reveal themselves fully to the world because they thought that they might be ready for what they want to offer them, which is pretty cool, actually, when you think about it. Because they came 1,000 years ago. I mean, their only mistake that they did that under the Muslim Empire, which was the least tolerant to other religions, and that they paid a big price for that. But they came down to Egypt, to Hakim bi-Amrillah, which was a Khalifa in Egypt. And they basically offered this new age, 1,000-year-old religion, coming and saying that there's one God. That's why they call the Druze Wahidun. They believe in one God from the word Wahid, Wahad. So there is one God, but different religions teach about the same God, only maybe in different ways. And they might have different teachers or prophets that came, but they're all trying to aim to the same God. So we should be more accepting towards these religions. And they also offered something very unique, which they started the separation of religion and state about 1,000 years ago. Only the religious people need to practice religion. The secular people, they're not expected to live and abide by the strict rules of religion. They just need to respect the traditions and live in it. And they don't feel the need to go and convert or change anyone. So when they offered that to the Khalifa, in the beginning they liked it. It was a cool idea. It was under the Shia that were more spiritual, you know, than the Sunnah, which is more orthodox and by the letter. But then they came and asked them a certain question. Wait, so can God send another prophet after Muhammad? And the Druze said, absolutely, if he chooses so, he can send. He can send anytime, you know, a messenger, servant to go and teach and tell people. So by that, they declare the Druze as kuffar, because Muhammad, the prophet,
infidels.
Came and said, infidels, exactly, that he is the seal of the prophets and no one can come after him. And Islam is the ultimate religion and no other version can be accepted. And that's, you know, where God wants the world to be. So the Druze started being persecuted and massacred, and they had to flee to live in the mountains mostly. And they became, in one hand, farmers, on the other hand, fighters, you know, to learn to defend themselves. And they moved and lived in the northern part of Israel, the area of the Galilee, in Lebanon and in Syria. The majority actually went to Syria. And there they were hiding for the last maybe 1,000 years, and often even completely disguising their religion so no one knows, because they wanted to kill them. So they had to pretend to be Muslims often, many times, which is something that is actually, we've seen that happen quite a lot. I mean, I have a friend in Israel. We probably know the husband. He's a lawyer in Israel, but his wife is from Holland, and their family name is Bueno de Muscat, the good mosque. And she's Jewish. And I asked her, like, very proud Jewish family, and I said, how come as a Jew your family name is the good mosque? And she said, well, when my family was under Muslim colonization, they had to hide their Jewish identity, and many Jews changed their family names and pretended to be Muslims just so they can survive. So the Druze did the same. And actually, until today, they're still doing the same, except one place. And that place is Israel. Israel is the only country that the Druze are actually comfortable and completely safe to put their flag up, to come and share their identity, to come and say who they are truly. And that's a very unique experience that the Druze didn't have for more than 1,000 years. And as the walls right now are falling, you know, Iran is collapsing, Hezbollah has been dismantled, the Assad regime fell down, the Druze around started hearing more and more about what's happening in Israel, and they're just amazed. They're amazed by how empowered we are as a minority in Israel. And they're seeing it right now, how we're the most strongest stand with the Druze in Syria, and the Christians, by the way, to prevent their massacre is coming from Israel, and it's coming from the Druze in Israel. They literally went and about to jump over the fence and run and fight to defend, you know, the Druze and the Christians in the mountain. So Druze in Lebanon and other places, they're like, wow. These Druze, we were told all these years that the Druze in Israel are living like slaves, that they're being oppressed, that they're afraid. And now, behold, it's exactly the opposite. We're the one that don't dare to speak, and they are just completely empowered. They just had a bunch of teenage girls from the village of Yarka send a satellite to space. Meanwhile, teenage girls in Syria are being kidnapped and becoming sex slaves and forced to see their family executed. So the history, kind of in a nutshell, of the Druze that brought them to that region. Right now, the Druze are still a secret religion. There's about 1 million of us, a little bit more, maybe 1.2 or 3 all around the world. Majority are in Syria, which is are experiencing a very dangerous ethnical cleansing that is happening. Then Lebanon, then Israel, some Jordan, and then Germany and, you know, Venezuela and kind of in the diaspora.
I actually know a few in America, and some of them are in very, very high position. Some of them are extremely gifted surgeon doctors and wonderful, wonderful people. And the thing is that we have Druze in Lebanon, we have Druze in Israel, and we have Druze in Syria. In Israel, for quite a long time, there were two groups of Druze. There's those who live in Galilee and Mount Carmel that were 100% identifying with Israel, and there were those on Golan Heights that were not sure what the prospect of the Golan Heights is going to be, and will an Israeli prime minister sign a deal that will give the Golan back to the Syrians? And so for many, many years, they were sitting on the fence, not sure to whom they should pledge their allegiance, simply because for them, it's a matter of death and life. and they will be massacred if they will become pro-Israeli and then go back to Syrian hands. Am I right to assume that?
You're 100% right. And I would even add, the borders, when they became the borders, they cut several of these Druze villages exactly in half. So suddenly you have one half living in Israel with complete freedom. And then the other half, you know, they see each other. They shout at each other with a megaphone. Is there under one of the most oppressive regime to ever, you know, walk this earth. So they were just terrified for their family. And they came and said, if today we pledge alliance to Israel, they're going to go and slaughter our family. And just like you said, if today we pledge alliance to Israel and tomorrow comes a government who under a peace agreement, because we've seen Israel do that in the past. They gave back Gaza. They gave back Sinai. Yes. It was something that was known that Israel is willing to go to an extreme extent sometimes in order to maybe have peace. It usually failed, but you know, the idea was there. So the Druze, who are very wise in surviving, because they've been surviving for 1,000 years, they knew that you need to be very smart how to play this game and not just make a statement right now because people want you to do that and they will be happy and clap their hands. You need to think generations to come, what's going to happen with our people? Because today we're here, tomorrow might be back there, and they're going to kill us all. Yeah.
And throughout this current war, there was one point where the Druze felt it really bad. During this war, there's a particular moment where the Druze people were actually targeted by Hezbollah, and that was when the rocket hit the playground at Majd al-Shams and killed instantly quite a few children there on the spot, which, by the way, I think was the accelerator to the Israeli decision to go and put an end to Hezbollah. Yep, take down Hezbollah. Fuad Shuker is the first one who was eliminated, the chief of staff of Hezbollah. And I think that was the immediate response. And then, of course, everything else. We know what happened with the pagers and the walkie-talkies and then the elimination of Nasrallah. And the rest is history. So the Druze understand, the Druze in Israel at least, then and on the Golan Heights particularly understood that Israel is not willing to let this atrocity go unanswered, and we are taking care of them. But then came the fall of the Assad regime, and sometimes someone once said that the devil that you know is better than the devil that you don't know, sometimes. And We knew the devil known as Assad family, but now we got a devil that most of the world does not know, and that's the jihadist al-Julani regime that the world is literally eating from their hands right now. And I think this is where
actually
I
worse
want
than Assad.
Absolutely worse, because Assad was not a jihadist. You can say many things about him, but he did not see the existence of minorities as a problem, whereas jihadists do. And so, you know, we're talking about December of 2024, we're moving into January of 2025. It's a new reality for the most part for the Druze people. And the Druze people woke up to understand that the central regime of their country in Syria is systematically, it began with the Alawites and Christians, and then, of course, they were the next. They realized that the vow of the jihadists is basically to exterminate and eliminate anyone that is not a Sunni Muslim. Tell us, when is it that the Druze in southern Syria realize they're in trouble?
So, just like you mentioned, after Israel started this snowball of basically destroying the enemies of Israel around the Middle East, and it was ignited by the death of the Druze children, like you mentioned. First of all, that alone has showed the Druze in Israel without no doubt that we are not second-class citizens. 12 Druze kids were killed, and Israel immediately went and took down the number two of Hezbollah and later on basically destroyed completely Hezbollah. Now, I'm not saying it's just because of these kids, but it just shows that Israel takes the life of its citizens very seriously. It doesn't matter if he's Jewish, Christians, Muslim, Druze, we are Israelis. And that is something beautiful about Israel. And even the Druze in Majd al-Shams saw that. Now, when Bashar al-Assad fell down, the Druze already knew that they're in trouble because Jawlani have already before sieged a Druze village with his ISIS and Al-Qaeda terrorists, and they executed more than 30 men, and they converted more than 1,000 Druze, and they took their daughters and their women as sex slaves. So that already happened, not only to the Druze, by the way, it happened to the Christians. There's many Christians in Syria that were under siege by Jawlani and his men before. Because
and when
was,
did that happen?
That happened, I don't remember exactly the year, but about 2-3 years ago, not too long ago. And almost
okay,
no one knows
so
about
before
it.
So because that was before he took over.
Before he took over, but not too long before. So it's still the same person, undoubtedly. Now, when the regime fell down and Jawlani took the seat, the Druze knew already that his plan is ethnically cleansing all of Syria and keeping only the Salafi Sunnah in it. This is the extremist. And the Druze came and said, no. Let's, if we want to build it, because they helped, by the way, defeat Bashar al-Assad. And often the Druze harbored in their mountain Christians and other groups, Yazidis, because they protected them. A crazy, very, very disturbing story that will help the world to understand how problematic it is when Islam becomes a majority, especially, you know, Islam unchecked. Jaramana, the Druze town where we started to see the massacres in the beginning, used to be a Druze province. They had a Druze
and
mayor.
And that's a suburb, a southern suburb of Damascus.
Exactly. A suburb of Damascus was a Druze suburb that have its own kind of, you know, authority, municipality, mayor, you can say. And when Bashar al-Assad was killing all of the people, Bashar al-Assad was basically a drug lord, a very secular drug lord who just did terrible things. But like you said, he was not trying to exterminate minorities. He was just equally evil to everyone. So many Muslims fled and lived under the protection of the Druze, along with Christians and others, because the Druze always knew how to survive and protect themselves relatively more than the rest in Syria. Only ones that knew to do that better were the Kurds, but that's because they had an official army sponsored by the US, CIA, and etc. So they were like on the next level. But inside that Mad Max jihadist world of Syria, the Druze were still standing strong and not succumbing to Sharia law. When Islam fled and lived under them, in the beginning it was like 100, 1,000, 5,000, 10,000, then it became 100,000, then it became almost a million of them. And what they did is they took over Jaramana and they started executing and killing the Druze. And we saw that with the fall of the regime and the people of Jawlani. One of the first things they did is they went and slaughtered the Alawites, and then they went and started killing the Christians. And then they came and they demanded that the Druze will hand out their weapons. Now the Druze, knowing the situation, that's when they started realizing things are going really bad. They came and said, sorry guys, listen, just yesterday you were sieging us, trying to murder us and take our daughters. Now you took over the government and you start giving weapons to Al-Qaeda and jihadists, you know, and ISIS. They have their patches with the uniform.
Oh, yeah.
And you give them even more weapons than before, and you want us to hand down our weapons. Yes, you need to do that. Sorry, we don't feel comfortable doing that unless you build a proper government, which is going to have proper democracy. You were not elected. You took it by force. And have a proper representation of the Christians, the Alawites, the Yazidis, the Kurds, the Druze, you know, all minorities, the Sunni. Jawlani said, no, absolutely not. He brought, you know, former Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden advisors with him and built a government. And then he went and he did what, and people might not understand sometimes, this is a religious ethnic cleansing. In the Quran, only a Muslim is allowed to hold a weapon. Christians and Jews are allowed to live as slaves. All the others need to be killed. And they're not allowed to build a new church. They're not allowed to build a house bigger than the Muslim house. They're not allowed to ride a horse or hold a sword. So one of the first interpretations of the Muslims in Syria now that they took over, we want to create a Muslim Ummah proper, textbook ISIS. And one of the first things, we need to disarm everyone who's not Muslim. We need to make sure that they live as slaves under us. And we need to take their women and children. It's insane, but this is exactly what it is. And the
And it's
Druze
21st
realize,
century. We're
as we're
21st century,
living.
and we're speaking in terms of 11th century.
Yeah, and the world is like falling for it and saying, oh, he's a good guy. He has a nice
Exactly.
jacket. He looks like a hipster. Let's give him money. So that's when the Druze came, and first time we heard a tweet coming from the Druze community saying, Israel, save us. In the beginning, it came as whispers. You need to understand, I have a relative of mine in Syria that was jailed for several years just because they found that he had a phone call with his relatives in Israel. So they don't even dare to say the word Israel. For so long, they were so afraid of even speaking about Israel. And now suddenly you're hearing Druze coming saying, Israel, save us. And that's because the Druze have realized that all the bridges have been burned down. And right now, even Bashar al-Assad was better than this guy because he at least protected the minorities. Now no one is protecting them. And if they don't seek for international help, they will be exterminated. And slowly, slowly, they started, suffering more and more attacks and more the cry for Israel, come and help us. Because they knew that Israel is going to be probably the only one that will go and help them. And with the help of the Jewish people and the Druze people and, all the minorities in Israel, Israel went and sent that message, hand off the Druze. And that's when the Druze started feeling a little bit kind of, okay, someone might actually come for our rescue when the day come. So all of that has been happening rapidly, this like understanding that there's a new reality. And they also started seeing the teachings that are happening, because Syria is becoming slowly, slowly the next Afghanistan. And there's radical teaching in the
Exactly.
streets.
And I always tell people, if you want to see how a regime is, don't look for what they say. Look at the textbooks in their schools. What they say to the international world is one thing, but what they teach their own is who they really are. And from what I gather, all the textbooks are now being transformed to pure jihadist doctrine indoctrination, which leaves no room for any minority to feel comfortable living under that regime. Am I right?
No, you're 100% right. It's a terrible reality. Textbook is right now teaching different teachings in the Islam that says that, for example, the texts that they're teaching right now about the Druze, and they're putting back these books in libraries and in schools, they says that the Druze are the worst of worst. They should be killed. Even a Druze woman, once you kill the man, you are not to convert her to Islam, even you are just to take her as a sex slave. Because in Islam, there's a word, usually one of the ways that Islam used to expand is they will kill the man and take the woman. And the moment that they have sex with that woman, and often, most likely, it's going to be by force, because she just killed her husband, she's considered Muslim. She doesn't have a say. And then if you want to leave, you can kill her. So there's one particular point where it's kind of a gray area where it's called Sabiyah. Not Sabaya, which is girls, Sibiya, which means that you can make her a sex slave, but it doesn't necessarily give her the same rights as a Muslim woman. So they're even saying that Druze women, you can just take them as sex slaves. You need to kill their men, take them as a slave. And that's what they're teaching in schools, universities now in Syria. That's how, like you said, 21st century. And the same thing they're saying
And
about the Christians and other groups. And we're seeing the entire street of Syria turning into the next Mosul, next Afghanistan. Soon you're going to start seeing even worse and worse stuff happening there. And the world is still asleep, on their nose. Sorry for cutting in, but have you seen the video of the execution of the doctors in the hospitals? There
Absolutely,
was
I've
just.
seen it. I posted it. It was terrible. I'm glad, by the way, that the footage from the hospital security cameras came out because at first they denied that anything happened there. I mean, there was footage of all the medical staff, including quite a few patients that were all massacred. But of course, they said they did not do it. But then came this footage. It was obvious. It was an HTS. It was and then now I see how they scramble to find us an an excuse. They said that, oh, that doctor jumped on the soldier, therefore he had to. They're so pathetic in the way they're trying to defend themselves, because they just don't want to admit who they are, because it doesn't look good. All those progressive liberals, they want to feel good with themselves. And so they don't want to live and go to bed with the thinking that they are supporting monsters. So they're telling them, please tell us you're not monsters. They're telling them back, we're not monsters. And every, I mean, that's it. It's all that it takes. The actions and the footage, they don't care about. Facts don't matter here. Facts are secondary. And I think that that's why what you're doing and what we're trying to do also is...
They went and they gathered the doctors like we saw. And I'm just posting right now another video about one of the doctors that survived. So he's actually showing and telling the story. So he is saying, showing us there how this guy that was executed, in the beginning, he offered everybody water, trying to calm the terrorists down. And then, you know, there's a saying in hostage rescue, a lot of times we tell the hostages, you know, when we train people how to become a hostage, don't try to be a hero. And that's the exact reason that guy was a hero. He stood there in front of one when they were all on the ground, and he gave water to the terrorists and trying to calm them down. We come in peace, showing his hands. So they flagged him already as someone that they want to make an example of. And then when he was down, they dragged him, and one of the guys punched him in the face and kicked him, and the other guy's pointing guns at him. And at that point, that guy, you know, he realized he's about to be executed. He jumped and tried to fight. And then they threw him down, and he started begging. He says, I didn't do anything to you. I did not. And bomb, he got shot in the head twice and in the chest. Now, there's another video that just came, and I'm getting all of this from my sources in Syria, because I have relatives there, Druze people that live there, and I've been talking to a lot of these fighters on the ground. By the way, some of them are Christians.
So you have personally relatives in Asueda?
Yeah.
So you get firsthand information?
Firsthand, with all the emotions unfiltered, with the tears, with the cryings, with the death.
And that's the thing that that people don't understand, is that when that footage is coming out, it's coming out from firsthand sources. It's not some washed thing that was filtered and doctored or anything. And they still don't want to believe that a massacre ever took place there. And if it took place, it must have been your fault. That's how they say it.
Yeah, in that hospital, actually, you see a guy who's wearing a black shirt and have like something on his hand. He is from the Syrian FBI, you know, the general security of the nation. And he is walking to the hospital, leading these soldiers of the government into the hospital. You see in many offices telling, go here, go there. So they already planned that raid on the hospital in advance by the FBI of Syria and their special forces. They call it the Red Band. So they used to be an extreme religious terrorist group, where you see Jawlani was like their leader. They were like the most extreme religious, and now they became the special forces of the government. So later on, they see them going around trying to graffiti and destroy cameras. And there's another video that surfaced. And, you know, like I said, I'm exposed to so many of these videos from firsthand, and we try to see sometimes which one is the most important for the world to see, because there's just so many of them. And it's still not helping. But you see, they managed to find the head of the surveillance cameras in that hospital. And they took him and they started threatening him to give them the code for the CCTV surveillance, because they wanted to delete all the images in the hospital. And he knew what they were planning to do, and he refused. And then they executed him on his knees. So there's a video, and you can see that Secret Service guy also there. He's literally in every video, with a black, you know, kind of shirt and a big beard and I think a cast on his hand or something. So then later on, they went to the doctors and started executing them. And one of the things that they told them was, if any of you talk or send a video, they took the phones from everyone, we will completely execute all of you. Now, little did they know that they were anyway planning to execute them, but they were still trying to get all their phones. So we saw an undoubtedly planned execution of an entire hospital with its medical staff and the innocent patients that were inside, including pregnant women that just gave birth I killed the mother and the child that was just born by the government that was planned before even the invasion.
Yes.
So if anyone had any doubt that the Syrian regime is planning to ethnically cleanse all the minorities in Syria, I think that doubt is long ago gone. But for some reason, mainstream media still cover for them, and world leaders still keep falling for Jawlani. And that's very dangerous.
It's very dangerous, and it's what I've been tagging as strong delusions. They truly believe the lie and reject the truth. And
Yes.
it breaks my heart because, as you know, unless you're called the Palestinian, no one will even listen to you. That's it. You have no chances. I mean, the places where there is real massacre, real ethnic cleansing, real genocide, real starvation, these places are being completely ignored. And wherever there is a fake narrative of genocide and starvation, everybody's buying the lie and rejecting the truth. And the Druze, unfortunately, are paying the price for it because the world's attention does not want to be divided. They prefer to focus on one thing and not to by any mean portray any other darling of the West as a villain. And it's very, very sad. I pretty much admire much of the US administration is doing for Israel, but there's one thing that I criticize the current US administration is their foreign policy in Syria, which they are backing this terrorist. They're talking to him. They legitimized him by meeting with him, by talking with him, by lifting the sanctions. They are legitimizing him and allowing others to feel free to do business with them,
Do you
such
want to
as the
know why?
UAE and Qatar.
Yeah, I have a very strong theory that, I've been
Please
hearing
tell me
from the
why.
Druze and from others, because I am a big supporter as well of this administration in the US, much better than the last one. And in general, I think America is one of the most important countries on planet Earth. If it wasn't for America, we'd all be living under Nazi Germany right now, or communist Russia, or I don't know what. So thank God for a strong America. But what happened here is there's a lot of Sunnah money involved in the picture. And Jawlani is a Sunnah boy, and the Sunnah don't want to lose Syria to the Shia. So they keep telling the Americans, don't listen to Israel, listen to us. Let us tell you the best picture for the Middle East. Keep Syria Sunnah. Jawlani, he listens to us. He's our boy. Turkey say that, Saudi Arabia say that, even Qatar is trying to say that. And Israel is saying a different story. No, guys, this guy is ISIS. What happened to you? Like last week, you had a bounty on him,
Exactly.
$10 million. Now he's not. So Israel is the only one speaking, sanity here. But the Arab world is telling America, don't listen. Israel is just going to cause problems here. Look what they did in Gaza. Please, they're going to drag you to another war. And America is getting like a bit, I feel, afraid of being portrayed as if they're being dragged by Israel, which Israel is not dragging them to any war. Israel is literally doing the right thing, and often they woke up and they join us when we went to attack Iran. No one wants Iran to have a nuclear weapon. They say death to America before they say death to Israel. So what happened here is that they made pressure on Israel not to get involved, and because of that, more Christians and Druze got slaughtered because they kept telling America, we got this under control. Don't let Israel go in and save the Druze. Because if Israel will go in fully save the Druze, which by the way, they did actually in the end, they didn't listen to anyone. And I'm very happy about Israel with that. That would make Jawlani look bad because the Sunnah Arab world is trying to portray an image of a moderate leader of Syria that want to make Syria great again. And if he is caught doing what he's actually doing, which is slaughtering his own people, his own citizens, burning them alive, his soldiers, raping their women, beheading them, like we've seen October 7, doing terrible stuff to the kidnapping their daughters and, you know, sex trafficking them and raping them and all, I don't know what. And all of that is done by the government, and Israel need to intervene to actually save the Syrian people from its own government, then the West will realize that, you know, Syria is not controlled by moderate Sunna. Syria became worse, and maybe it was better for the Shiite to go. Or even the Shiite might start trying to come back and say, see, we did better. So in order to prevent the loss of the Sunna hold over Syria, they're buying their way throughout entire the world, kind of media outlets, and they're making deals with America, $100 billion deals, and I don't know what, and telling, just give us a chance here, we'll tell you how it's done, meanwhile ignoring Israel. And just like you said, it's very embarrassing and very disappointing to see that such a good administration that up until now was doing such a great job of actually, you know, standing on the right side with Israel, in that particular case about Syria, is choosing to take the advice of foreign players that, by the way, don't have the same interest like America, like Israel does. And I think in many, many aspects, Israel and America, you know, each country needs to take care of itself, but they rarely ever have contradiction, you know, in how they want to see the world in the future. They're very similar in their cultures and their values. For Islam, the worst thing that can happen is that they would lose land. And that's why you would see Saudi Arabia one day all against Palestine, all against Muslim Brotherhood and Al Jazeera and all their friends. But then Donald Trump want to buy Gaza, and then suddenly Saudi Arabia will be all pro-Palestine and against Israel. Why is that? Because they're playing the game. And in the end, they still want to expand. And the worst thing that they can see is when they lose land. That's why it terrifies them also what's happening in Gaza. And in Syria, if Israel would have went and saved these minorities as they wanted to, that would have made the Arabs look really bad. And maybe Israel would have even conquered more land. Because if you think about it, all these minorities that are running away right now from the north part of Syria all the way to the border with Israel, they're running to seek shelter by Israel. The safest place in Syria have became by the occupied IDF land in Syria. These villages are the safest place in Syria now, and everybody want to run there. Because there you get medical treatment, you can sleep at night with your door open, you have no fear that someone's going to kidnap your children because the IDF is protecting you in Syria. So if Israel goes in, a lot of these minorities actually come and says, Israel, please conquer us. Please come and take this area and let us be your citizens. Christians are saying that, Alawites are saying that, Druze are saying that, a lot of minorities are saying that, and that is scaring the living cow poop out of the Sunni world, because that will just expose even more and more what a failing countries they have and religion or practice they have when it comes to these things. Yeah. So they're trying to hush it. And people are paying with lives for that.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. Every time Israel is poised to take land, suddenly the whole Muslim world is on its, you know, on its feet and trying to stop us from doing that. You know, right now, even now, we're talking about taking over Gaza City and the central. I mean, basically, even considering annexation of parts of Gaza. Of course, that doesn't go well down their throat. What in your mind is the best solution for this problem? If you had to craft a solution for the minorities, or for the most part, the Druze people in Syria, what would be the best solution that you can think of?
Well, I spend a lot of time thinking about the best solution, and I think I have two. Number one, and then if it doesn't work, then number two. Because I know, I believe from my time in the service, you don't come only with a problem, you come with a solution. So I think the best solution would be if Israel would have actually conquered these areas and made the Druze mountain and all the area part of Israel. That's the best solution, because I would wish what I have to anyone else in the Middle East, to be a citizen of Israel. To be an Arab living in Israel is the best life in the Middle East, and I can only wish for my relatives there to live the life that I have, to be able to walk freely, to be able to not hide their religion, to be not fear that the government is going to come and slaughter them in front of their kids, rape their mothers and kidnap their children. So that would be the best one. That's a far off, and you know, it's very hard to see it happening. Another solution that I would say is number two is the world intervention to first recognize Syria as a failing terrorist state, which they are. They're not even hiding it. And then to start for once caring for the minorities in the Middle East and not for the Muslims. The Muslims are not a minority. There's 2 billion of them. And actually, they're the aggressors. Not all, but in general, all these crimes are happening under Muslim world. So start caring for the minorities and help the Druze, the Alawites, the Christians, the Yazidis in the southern part of Syria with the border with Israel to establish their own, call it federal states. So they can still be under a Syrian flag, use the Syrian, you know, coin, etc., but they will have their own autonomy and independence like Texas, like other places where they come and say, if you come at us, we can come back and take care of ourselves. We're not going to succumb to that. So that means that these areas will not be forced to live under Sharia law, and they can actually live and practice their own religion and faith peacefully. And they will be by default under the protection of Israel in some aspect. They don't need to be Israeli citizens even, because in the end, they serve as a buffer zone from all these, you know, religious fanatics, Sunnah, that is in the center of Syria. Let them play jihadist games with themselves. Let the Christians have autonomy over their life. Let the Druze have autonomy over their life. Let the Alawites, let the minorities live in peace. And what will happen if this will be the goal that the West will push? Now, it's very unlikely to do that because, unfortunately, these minorities are not rich. So usually they don't have a lot of money to offer. So people kind of ignore them and just let them suffer. But if someone will come with a very good idea of, that's going to be my legacy. I'm going to make sure that from now to 500 years from now or 100 years, children will live safely in the southern part of Syria, and I will push for that agenda, you will end up having Israelis and Americans and Europeans going to Israel and going traveling to Syria, Jewish people going to Syria, Syrians coming to Israel, because there's no terrorism there. You will start having agriculture, start having science, you start having schools and businesses flourish there because there's no jihadists to come and blow it up and teach radical UNRWA, you know, teachings. So you will end up empowering this region so strongly and creating like a mini Europe in the Middle East that have Jews, Christians, Muslims, Druze, Yazidis, Kurds, Alawites living peacefully. No one is trying to kill anyone and safely. So I think that would be the best option because let's be honest about it. Syria does not belong to Jolani or to ISIS. Syria is bigger than most countries in Europe. Syria have 20 million people in it, and not all of them, you know, are Muslims. The majority are. So if the Christians, Syria used to be Christian even before. So if we start giving back the people in Syria their own autonomy over themselves and not have them been forced to live under Sharia law, which right now, everyone in Syria, except for the Druze, have succumbed to Sharia law. That's why you barely hear any Christians talking because they're too afraid. They bomb their churches, they kill their daughters. You don't hear Alawites because they slaughtered almost all of them and they're terrified right now. The only ones that are still standing tall and not bending a knee are the Druze. And many of the Christians and the other groups are fleeing to the Druze mountain to be protected by them. So I think that it's fair to give these minorities a peaceful life once and for all and have them be in the border with Israel and let the jihadists play jihadist games somewhere else. That's, I think, will be the best solution. I think it's a practical one, but it just needs, like I said, the world to do something about it. And if one thing we've learned about the world, you know, Amir, is that it's keep repeating itself. In the Holocaust, they knew what was happening to the Jews and they chose to turn a blind eye. And now they teach all about it and watch movies and everybody sits home. And when he watches movies, he says, I'm going to be like Schindler. I'm going to save people. I'm going to be a hero. Yeah. I'm not going to let an honor front. But then it happens again. People close their eyes. So now it's happening again. There's an onslaught, a massacre of minorities happening in the Middle East under Islam. And the world is, again, turning a blind eye. And probably our grandchildren, 40 years from now, when they read books, they will say, like, I can't believe our parents. I'm so embarrassed of these parents. If I was there, I would have not let this happen. They would see the images of these little girls being kidnapped and massacred. Yeah. And they will sit and just tell themselves, I would have done it differently. And now it's our turn. Mm. It's happening around us. What are we doing? The Druze are experiencing now what the Jews experienced during the Holocaust. They're being slaughtered. And they have no country, they have no real army, they don't have money. They're just farmers trying to live a peaceful life. Mm-hmm. And no one is caring about them. And the only one that is caring is Israel, and Israel is getting all the heat for it. So,
yeah. I can conclude, as we're coming to the end, I can conclude with this. What I think we see now is a spiritual warfare. I think that beyond what looks like flesh and blood and people, there's a, there's no doubt the world is being blinded by the enemy. I see spiritual blindness. I see spiritual warfare. And I truly believe, and you know, you can probably agree with me, that the only solution eventually for the problems of the Middle East, the problems of the world, and to bring real everlasting peace is by putting your trust in the Prince of Peace, the Lord of Peace, that can give us peace now and forever, here and everywhere. And that's, of course, Yeshua. And I hope and pray that as many as we can share the message of hope and peace that can come through faith in the Messiah, which, by the way, he is not just for Israel. He's not just for this Europe. He is the Lamb of God that came to take away the sin of the whole world. And only once you put your trust in him, you truly learn, even in the most troublesome place on earth, you will finally find peace. I wish everyone would hear your suggestions. Unfortunately, the world is hypocrite. Unfortunately, the world follows money, follows power, follows the things that are of this world and not of God himself. So again, my prayer for you, as you continue doing this good job in exposing the evil and trying to get the attention, my prayer for you is also that people will ask you always about your faith, about your journey, about how you found peace in this troubled world. And my prayer is that more than your words, your life and the one who lives in you will shine his light to everyone, both your relatives in Syria and everyone that is listening to you when you try to persuade them to pay attention to what is going on. Mansour, I want to thank you for being on this podcast. You've done a great job in explaining what's going on. And I pray and hope that the people of Syria will finally find one day a rest. And until then, we can only pray, because as we can clearly see, it's not just a power and struggle of flesh and blood. And in this type of thing, we need also to pray and to be part of this fight in the spiritual realm as well. I want to you to say hi to your wife and to your child. Great success in your efforts to spread the good word and the truth. We're going to put down in the lower third right now your social contacts of how people can get in touch with you, how they can follow you on social media and support what you're doing. Thank you. Any final words you want to say?
I just wanted to say thank you for giving us a voice on behalf of the Druze. I've been receiving messages from Druze in Syria that have been telling me that I became their official voice in English, and I've never asked that responsibility, but I took that task very seriously, doing my best to bring the voice out there. I know you have a huge channel, you know, in the Telegram. I was just amazed. It's like, what, 600,000 people in your Telegram even. And I was so honored that you came and gave us a platform to speak. We are a small community. The world is ignoring us. And if no one will pay attention, this community can be eradicated from the face of the earth under the Muslim world. And only in Israel they will stay alive. And we can't allow this to happen. So thank you and anyone out there that is praying for us, that is remembering us. It's very hard to have a voice when 600,000 of your people are living under oppression with no internet. Yeah. They cut the internet on them, and the only one that can speak for them are the ones in Israel and Lebanon and some diaspora around the world, but we are little and they are many. So every chance like this, every channel that invites us to come and talk about the Druze, we will be there. I will be there and I will talk as much as I can on behalf of my brothers and sisters in Syria. And I want to personally thank you and all of your staff for reaching out and giving me this, you know, opportunity. God bless you guys. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mansour. And thank you, everyone, for watching this Anchor podcast. Until next time, shalom and goodbye from Galilee.